Good morning. It's Friday, July 3rd from HPR2. It's The Conversation. A federal judge has rejected yet another bill aimed at regulating Hawaii's biotech industry. What's going on here? We'll hear from Michael Carroll, attorney for Sustainable Hawaiian Agriculture for the Keiki and the Environment. And what can Hawaii educators learn from best practices and innovative programs around the country? HSTA President Will Okabe will check in from the National Education Association's annual Representative Assembly.
Watching your life flash before your eyes in your own short film with the Ohina Short Film Showcase. And creating a brand image with design, we'll talk with Creative Director of Brand Studios, Eric Reese, about his latest project.
The conversation starts right after the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Beth Ann Kozlovich is on vacation this week, and Kathy Kozak is joining me. Thanks for being here, Kathy.
Happy to be here. You know, it's the weekend of putting aside our complaints about the U.S. and celebrating the fact that we're here.
Celebrating the fact that we're free to have our complaints about the U.S., you know. And earlier this morning, Kathy, they read the text of the Declaration of Independence on NPR, and I was struck once again by the precision and the beauty of that language. It's a wonderful document.
It is. This would be a great weekend for everybody to take a look.
Yeah, go back and think about the language in it. And the language of measures is part of our concerns in our opening conversation. For the third time, a bill to regulate the use of genetically modified organisms in Hawaii has been struck down by the court, this time in a federal court ruling on a Maui County measure calling for a moratorium on GMO crops. As with earlier rulings on Kauai and Hawaii Island, courts have raised concerns of what are referred to as invalid and unenforceable measures that are preempted by state or federal law. There's an apparent disconnect here between the popular will and the laws the courts are mandated to follow. Attorney Michael Carroll represents the SHACA movement, which is appealing the latest federal court ruling. The acronym stands for Sustainable Hawaiian Agriculture for the Keiki and the Environment, and Michael is with us this morning. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Federal Judge Susan Mulway cited a specific problem with the latest Maui bill, which is what?
Well, her decision basically rules that local ordinances or state ordinances cannot adopt regulations that address GMOs and that it's preempted by federal law, and that the county law is also preempted by state law. And the impact of the ruling today, or the impact of the ruling with respect to if this were to be upheld, is that it would potentially prevent any counties from adopting any laws that would regulate GMO crops. For example, there are regulations throughout the country dealing with prohibiting GMOs in various counties and also requiring labeling on the local level. If this decision were to be upheld on appeal, this would prevent and preclude any other counties from adopting these regulations.
Not just in Hawaii, but across, anywhere.
Anywhere, that's correct.
In the country. That's correct. This becomes, it looks as if that would be a high court issue, at least a circuit, Ninth Circuit, or beyond decision to be adjudicated. Yeah?
This will definitely go to the Ninth Circuit, and there's always a good likelihood that this could go to the U.S. Supreme Court, given that this is a potential case that could impact the entire country.
In general, when a law is passed that is redundant to federal or state law, it gets knocked down, right? If it's duplicative of something already on the books, and that was what was cited here, yeah.
Yeah, the distinction that we have in our case is that the harms that are impacting the Maui County are not being addressed or not being regulated on the federal level. For example, there is a Ninth Circuit decision that says that the exact harms that our ordinance seeks to protect are not being addressed by the federal government under the Plant Protection Act that Judge Mulway said precludes counties from acting. These include the increased chemical use, the transgenic contamination and other harms associated with GMO crops.
The Plant Protection Act being a federal law, which, right?
That's correct.
Which says what?
It basically protects from noxious plants. And under various regulations, there is a procedure that the seed companies can follow to develop new crops. And that's part of the process in which that the federal government, or Judge Mulway said, preempted counties mm-hmm. from regulating. But the problem is that this federal review process, or this federal process, doesn't actually test or doesn't actually do any studies on the harms associated with GMO crops. They're more interested in confining the seeds and confinement issues. They're not addressing the issues of increased pesticide use and the issues of transgenic contamination and other issues that the Maui Ordinance sought to protect.
Is that just a matter of there? If it's that clear cut, if there's language that is not present in the federal law, that would actually be a pretty strong avenue for you to argue, wouldn't it?
And that was one of our points that we raised with the district court that was ultimately not accepted. But we do intend to raise that on appeal. Another issue that we have is that the Hawaii Constitution has very strong language in giving the counties authority to regulate agriculture and to protect the environment. And we did make reference to that in our briefs, and unfortunately that was not accepted by the district court, but we are hopeful that we'll have better success on appeal.
So the federal ruling that was just made on the Maui County measure, if you apply that logic, its logic across the board, would make it impossible for any county anywhere.
That's right. Judge Mulway basically said that any regulations on GMOs on the county or state level would be precluded or prevented by federal law. And any counties that tried to place a ban or place a similar moratorium on GMO operations, they could not do that because it's preempted and prevented under the federal government.
Wasn't there some language in her decision, I'm trying to remember exactly how it was phrased, but saying that the judge essentially said, I'm not addressing the science here, but more in terms of the way the laws are written?
Yes, she spent a number of pages in her introductory talking about that she's not deciding whether GMOs are good or
yeah.
bad. And again, I don't think this measure really goes to that issue as well, because what we're asking for is that there be studies done to make sure that what is the actual activities are being safe. This bill does not address whether GMO food consumption is a good or a bad thing. It's talking about a specific practice and how the chemical companies are using Maui in a different way to develop their crops that is harmful to the community, and that's why the Maui voters voted in favor of this ordinance.
Had you written the law in such a way as to make a sort of a blanket condemnation of GMO research, it likely would be knocked down because you would not be in a position to make a statement like that.
Well, there's a lot of different variations in the bills, and I think if there was it's hard to say if there was a large bill that would completely ban the importation and exportation, you'd have a completely different situation.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the case before Maui.
So essentially, the Maui bill was written in order to address something specific, and from your perspective, the federal court did not really tune in on that specific provision.
That's correct, Chris, and they didn't focus on the points that we wanted the court to focus on, and we're hopeful that the Ninth Circuit will look afresh at these issues and see that these issues are not being regulated by the state or federal government, and the counties should have the power to do so, and this was a proper exercise of local police powers.
Absent a favorable Ninth Circuit ruling, you would still have the option of going all the way to the top, to the Supreme Court, yeah?
That's right, Chris.
And that's an option that's still in the wind?
And well, we're hopeful that we will be successful at the Ninth Circuit. Of course, if we were successful, the industry plaintiffs could also potentially file an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court as well.
All of which tells us we're not done with this issue by a long shot,
yes,
right?
I think we will possibly be back next year.
That's quite safe to say. Michael, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Michael Carroll is a Honolulu attorney who represents the Shaka Movement. That stands for Sustainable Hawaiian Agriculture for the Keiki and the Environment. And you can learn more about the ongoing dispute over the GMO measure on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14. Later in the show, the Ohina Short Film Showcase looks at ways to keep it concise. But first, your quiz.
Ulana, umau, ukaholabe, uhawaii.
Hawaii's beekeeping industry began on the island of Oahu on a Sunday afternoon in 1893. On this particular afternoon, a swarm of bees was caught by the trade winds, blown into the backyard of two brothers living in Honolulu. Their names were Lee and Oswald St. John Gilbert, and with virtually no knowledge of honey production, the two brothers began constructing their own hives and researching cutting-edge beekeeping techniques. After a short time in the industry, the brothers St. John Gilbert created the Sandwich Island Honey Company, which is considered the first company dedicated to the commercial production of honey and beeswax in Hawaii. For all his contributions to the industry, Oswald St. John Gilbert earned a distinct nickname and title. For today's backyard quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us this nickname. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. If you're the first caller to get it right, you'll win an HPR t-shirt.
Good morning. I'm Steve Businger from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation at HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Show, don't just tell. It's one of the mantras of good writing and good filmmaking as well. So how do you encapsulate a full story into a short film? Well, Gerard Elmore from the Ohina Short Film Showcase is in the studio to tell us more about the creative process and how he helps Hawaii's independent filmmakers get their stories out to the community for all to see. Welcome to The Conversation.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Kathy.
What was the inspiration for the Ohina Short Film Showcase?
Well, it actually was started about 15 years ago. Jeff Katz and Jason Sua Paia were the founders. And actually, the beginning was they couldn't quite get into the Hawaii International Film Festival, so they started Ohina as another opportunity to have their short films play. But it actually became something where it was something that could just support local filmmakers and their stories. And here we are continuing it on after all these years.
So now there are some particular requirements. This really is about films about Hawaii or Hawaii filmmakers.
Right.
There are some rules.
Right. There's just a couple rules. And the main one is it has to be Hawaii. It has to be a Hawaii filmmaker, or it has to be a film that represents Hawaii or tells a story that's local. It's not international films. We're not trying to compete against any other film festivals. This is just a venue that we provide to try to bring up these newcomers from Hawaii and give them a place to tell their stories and a screen to show their movies.
And those are the only rules: content, choice of the filmmaker.
Yeah, there's no content requirements. We don't want to censor. We want them to tell the story that they want to tell. We have student filmmakers, we have professional filmmakers, but we don't tell them you can't do this and you can't do that. Of course, we don't want anything that's very explicit. But other than that, it's there's no rules. We just want you to tell your story.
Age independent.
Again, you know.
Kids can get GoPros, put them on their head, take a picture or take a film, and if it tells a good story, bring it on.
Yeah, you know. Sometimes we always preach that it doesn't matter what it looks like, and actually, good audio can go a long ways, you know. And it's just in the end, the judges always tend to favor good stories over the visual quality or the production value of the films. And the thing is, I never see all the films. I'm not a programmer, you know, and the way that Ohina is structured, we give it to people who are all over the place and do different things, and they decide what gets in. So we have a panel of people decides to get it, who gets in, and there's no awards. Getting into the showcase is the award because it's so tough, and the competition is actually sometimes harder than actually getting to HIFF.
So basically the process is that you submit your film,
mm-hmm.
and there are judges of people in the industry who know a bit more about filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get your film accepted, then it's going to play and people are going to have a chance to see it.
Yeah.
When and where?
This year we're going to be at the Doris Duke Theater over at the Museum of Art. It'll be August 14th through 16th. And one of the things that makes Ohina beautiful is that we get multiple screenings of the same shorts, sometimes at another festival or, you know, even festivals on the mainland, you only get one or two shots. The whole thing about Ohina is that we'll give you multiple screenings to sort of fine tune your film if you're still trying to find that edit or the, you know, something that clicks with the film. And also it gives them exposure, you know, to have a, sort of like a theater run like you would with a big movie. But we're just there to support them and to promote them and do our best with that.
Now, what happened the first time you submitted a film to Ohina?
Great question. My first experience with Ohina is my film was rejected. And I was really bitter about it, to be quite honest. And I submitted that same film to HIFF, and HIFF submitted actually accepted it. And I just kept thinking, wow, this is so weird. I can get into HIFF, but I can't get into Ohina, you know. But the thing is, I never gave up, and I kept submitting each year until I finally got into Ohina. And then after that, I would constantly get in. But I think the important lesson is you can't just give up if you don't get in. The reason you don't get in, there's always a reason, you know, and it doesn't mean that you suck, you know, necessarily. It just means that it just quite didn't work for some reason.
Well, and that's one of the hard things, I think, here in the islands is a way to give constructive criticism such that it can help people to improve their filmmaking skills. I mean, sometimes it's really hard to really tell somebody where they might need to refine either their story or how they're doing it and not necessarily have people get all upset about it.
Yeah, there's no easy way in Hawaii, you know. To be quite honest, we're you know, I don't want to say anything to get me in trouble, but we try to be nice. And
you got rejected first. You were already in trouble, but look, yeah, you turned it around.
Right, and the thing is, we're not here to tear people down, and there is a right way to do it. And I think the best thing, and the thing I try to say when this happens is that you're a great filmmaker. I was rejected, and I ended up becoming a better filmmaker. I still don't consider myself a great filmmaker. I do a lot of great work, and that's because there's teams that help me do it. But you need to start somewhere, and you become a filmmaker through these trials and tribulations, and it's what builds you and what makes you the filmmaker you want to be, which is you're never going to win on the first try. If you're a stand-up comic and you go up the first time, you're not going to be hilarious. You're going to die. People are going to think you know, you're not
good
at all.
We enjoy those videos, right,
right.
Exactly. So it really is about putting yourself out there, giving it a try.
Yep.
And this is a great way to showcase our local filmmakers and give them a chance to find an audience. That's fantastic.
Right.
Thanks for sharing your information with us and just getting us excited about the film festival.
No problem. Thank you.
The Ohina Short Film Showcase final films have been selected and will be announced later this month. The premiere will be at the Doris Duke Theater August 14th, 15th, and 16th. More information on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Does math really teach you how to think, or is that just what they tell you to get you to study your integrals? I'm Ira Flatto. Join me on Science Friday as we debate the pluses and minuses of how we learn math, and we'll solve some puzzles, too. Plus, what can you learn from a hole in the head? We'll talk about the brain injuries that change neuroscience, all on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after The Conversation.
The International Astronomical Union is coming to town in August for a prestigious conference that will bring 2,000 of the world's top scientists to Honolulu with a planned side trip to Mauna Kea that could get awkward. The storm of protest over the planned construction of a 30-meter telescope there is unlikely to have died down, and Chad Blair of Civil Beat is on the line with today's reality check to look at what we might expect. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris, and happy 3rd of July.
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, there's potential for one thing, a lot of news coverage of the telescope controversy in connection with this conference, yeah?
Well, it's ironic. I mean, this organization, they meet once every 3 years, and the Honolulu conference was planned 6 years ago. So, they, you know, there's no way they could have known there was going to be a controversy over the TMT, even though Mauna Kea, of course, has had a long history. You know, one of the questions is will they be able to visit Mauna Kea? At least as of now, the road to the summit is closed. Construction is on hold. And, of course, the protesters or protectors, whatever characterization you wish to use, they are insistent on remaining opposed to the TMT being built on Mauna Kea.
And, you know, I expect the last time this body met, the perception of Hawaii was really as a kind of mecca for astronomical research. That seems to be rapidly changing, yeah?
Yeah. You know, it's there's little doubt, at least from the scientific community, the value of Mauna Kea as a research site to be able to view the heavens. You know, our reporter Jessica Terrell did talk to Kealoha Pishoda, and she's over there on the Big Island and has been perhaps one of the most outspoken persons against the TMT as well as use of Mauna Kea, period, mm-hmm. for scientific purposes. She's hoping that the conferees, the astronomers that are coming to town, will actually start thinking about how astronomy, in her words, causes stress to native peoples. There is actually some possibility that those protesters might actually be able to meet with the astronomers. There's talk about actually having some sort of dialogue. So that could certainly be a very interesting development.
One possible way that this whole controversy could shake out is in having future projects have a lot more concern for where they're being built.
Yeah, but you know the thing about astronomy is there's only so many spots in the world that have this kind of I mean, think about it. Mauna Kea is, what, 13,000 feet? I think there's only a site in Chile that's comparable, Chile and South America, in terms of its astronomical potential. Of course, there's Haleakala on Maui. But certainly folks will be thinking about whether it is worth their time, their energy, their money, to invest in telescopes on Mauna Kea, given what could transpire, people building ahu on the road, scattering large rocks to prevent people from driving up there. This is really a fascinating fascinating standoff that who knows whether it'll be resolved by the time the astronomers come. The conference is in early August, I believe.
Fairly unlikely, but certainly it's going to be a surprise to at least some of the scientists who come here.
Yeah, I should just note, by the way, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs is going to be advising the Astronomical Union, rather, on opening and closing ceremonies that are culturally appropriate and sensitive.
Well, there's going to be some educating being done on a variety of fronts. Thanks very much for this, Chad.
Thanks, Chris. Have a good weekend.
You bet. You too. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com. It's Friday, and every Friday at this time, we check in with our HPR news department. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. Thanks for coming in, Bill. What are you working on?
Yeah, well, Chris, you know, a lot of things on tap next week. On homelessness, continuing attention there. Seems like every day new developments on homelessness, especially in Honolulu. This week, State Representative Tom Brower going through Kaka'aka with a video camera, getting assaulted. The continuing growth of that settlement there. But we want to try to put some of this in some context where we can, and part of that is answering some basic questions and hearing from groups that work with the homeless. So next week, I'm going to take a closer look at one portion of the homeless, the older side of the demographic scale. You know, the group Focused found that a third of the chronically homeless population is 50 years or older, and nearly a third of that group is over 60. So in addition to various other challenges, there are some complications here. And they also stretch to federal programs like Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid.
Sure.
Catholic Charities has been doing some work in this area, taking, again, a closer look at this, and we're going to hear more about this this coming week.
Well, this is part of a whole overall movement to find out exactly who the people are and how they break down demographically.
Exactly, and going deeper than that just sort of surface cursory glance and sometimes the shrug of the shoulders that some people become inured to that, that's definitely part of that.
All under the category of humanizing an abstract issue, abstract to many, right?
Very true.
What else you got?
Well, so we got some local politics going. As you know, somebody following local politics for years, always some interesting themes to look at.
Oh, yeah.
And Wayne Yoshioka is always poking around looking for some. Next week, he's going to be looking at the issue of candidate recruitment for local Republicans. This can be an uphill battle for the GOP. The Oahu chapter of the Hawaii GOP looking for candidates for 2016. And that's, not only challenging, but it's a bit involved in terms of the process. So Wayne's going to sort of pull the screen back a little bit on that.
You know, for some aspiring candidates, a good spell opportunity, because there have been a number of races locally where they just didn't field a Republican candidate at all.
No, that's true. And it's, against the broader context of political developments in Hawaii. So it'll be, all in all, interesting week and a couple of other things on tap that we'll get to next week.
You know, they're all interesting if you look hard enough. That's the great thing about news, right?
You bet.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Chris.
Bill Dorman is Hawaii Public Radio's news director. The concerns of educators around the country are being brought to the fore this weekend at the National Education Association's annual Representative Assembly in Orlando, Florida. 9,000 educators from around the country have assembled to compare notes about school funding, so-called Common Core standards, and ways to pass along a lifelong love of learning. Will Okabe, outgoing president of the Hawaii State Teachers Association, is in Orlando, and he's on the line with us now. Good morning, Will.
Good morning.
It's good to, thanks for
Aloha.
Taking the time to talk with us. Yeah. You know, this is, it really can be an opportunity for Hawaii, don't you think, to sort of find out what concerns are shared, what concerns are not, that kind of thing?
That's correct. I mean, here at the, in Orlando, we're talking about 7,000 educators coming together to, you know, discuss a lot of the issues that pertain to public education.
Which are what? What are the ones that you hear most often talked about?
Well, we're basically, you know, talking about testing. We're talking about all different types of issues of how No Child Left Behind on ESEA is going to be addressed at the national level in Congress. Those are the things that are going to be discussed here at this convention.
You know, one of the things...
Of course, they're going to also touch on probably presidential election candidates.
Sure.
Where the NEA will be going in the 2016 election cycle. All of those things are going to be discussed here at the convention.
Well, let's just look at testing for a second, because I know that comes up again and again in discussions of, and you know, as we hear more and more, and as the population diversifies, it seems like the whole idea of having a standardized way to assess student performance seems to be moving in kind of a different direction. It's difficult to impose any kind of one size fits all. Description of what needs to be done, yeah?
That's correct. I mean, you know, educators from all over the country here in Orlando will be talking about education policy and what is best for our students that our 3 million members in the NEA will be concentrating on. So it's a, you know, it's a national concern, but I think the focus really needs to be about the students learning, their success, and how education is going to help our students learn. I think that's the key element in our objective here at the NEA.
I would hope that would always, that was always a primary focus of education, but you know, I guess it comes down to the how of meeting that goal, yeah?
That's correct. I mean, it's the how, it's making the test that they're trying to implement not only in Hawaii but across the country to make it fair and equitable, and to make it make sure that whatever the test is given to the students are appropriate to, you know, learning. I mean, it's not just about giving a test and trying to encourage teachers to just teach to the test.
Yeah.
That's not the importance. It has to be a very whole learning type of concept. That when students go into the classroom, they're, you know, trying to be independent thinkers, trying to develop creativity. All of those things are very important in learning. So we're, you know, we're talking about issues such as schools not just going to a charter school. In some schools here in the continental United States, it's based on a lottery system to get into a charter school. Mm-hmm. It's not based on should not be based on a zip code. Because you live in a certain area, let's say in Hawaii, that you live in a certain area, that you should have more opportunities than other areas in the state of Hawaii. And, you know, schools in the on the continental United States have those very same concerns, because unlike the continental United States, Hawaii is one school system. On the continental United States, it's run by counties, depending on property taxes. So you could have one area of a school district that has more opportunities than others because of the funding at their school. But we believe in Hawaii that everyone should have the same opportunities. So it's only through working with the legislature, making the community understand that it's how important it is that education becomes a forefront, not just a word, that we support public education or just education in general. But we need to really put funds behind that to really give every child an opportunity to learn.
Well,
so more time in the classroom, more time in teaching to help the students learn.
Well, the things that you're describing, they don't sound like the kind of things that anyone could argue with. Equality of opportunity,
yes.
More classroom time for teachers. So, you know, What's the difficulty in meeting that goal, those goals?
Well, I think that many times what happens is every state is facing a situation on funding.
Yeah.
funding is one of the key elements in order to, you know, fund the things that we want. I mean, you know, what people talk about private schools. Private schools have every opportunity to give their students the things that they need. Mm-hmm. They have smaller class sizes in their classroom. They have the technology involved.
Sure.
All of these things the public school teachers want, and we recognize that. So all we want to be able to give the students in Hawaii, the public school students, the same opportunities. And you will find that's one of the basic things about more time for teaching and learning, one-on-one opportunities for the kids, and teaching the students as a whole, you know, whether it's giving opportunities for them to have drama classes, physical education, you know, all of these things, you know, that not only just the core subjects in math, science, you know, and history, they should have an opportunity to have fine arts in their classes, in their curriculum, to be able to have that. But I think somewhere along the, throughout the country, we've kind of swayed away from that. There was a time when all the nations in the world emulated the education system in the United States, because most of the creativity came from the United States of inventions. So now we're kind of swaying that back to a testing mode, and I think that you know, we need to relook at that. And I think that hopefully the leaders from around the country will start to recognize the importance of a whole child learning.
Let's hope so, Will, and thanks very much for taking the time to talk with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you for having us. I mean, it's here in the afternoon right now. It's about 2:30 or so in the afternoon, and I'm going to tell you this, for those listeners in Hawaii, nothing beats Hawaii. We have thunderstorms here, a lot of rain, lightning, and it's very, very hot and humid here in Orlando.
You've even got
but
alligators.
Of course, you have Disney World and you have Universal Studios, but you cannot compare the lifestyle in Hawaii.
I don't think too many people would argue with you, Will. Thanks very much. Will Okabe is the outgoing president of the Hawaii State Teachers Association. He's also a teacher at Hilo High School. Will, along with the HSTA delegation, is in Orlando for the National Education Association's annual representative assembly. And you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Aloha, I'm Steve Shiraki from the Hawaii State Department of Education. You are tuned to HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HIConversation.
It's Friday, which means we read your letters and emails, and following Wednesday's show, we got this.
I listened with great interest to the conversation with Catherine Zion about the governor's veto of SB 265. I was very disappointed with the actual lack of information contained in the interview. How many women, men, and children are held as slaves in the state? Are they from here or brought here from foreign sources? Who are the pimps? Who are the recruiters? Who precisely profits from the trade? Are all prostitutes victims or slaves? How do you differentiate between men and women working and making money as prostitutes and, quote, sex slaves? Should these two classes of workers be treated differently? Should prostitutes be prosecuted and slaves be exempt? I'm not being moralistic about this. I believe prostitution should be decriminalized and regulated like the Nevada model. Let the state profit off this trade instead of the pimps. To paraphrase Mark Twain, the only criminal class in the U.S. is the government. And this is from a guy who is generally regarded as a crazy liberal. Ms. Zion is broad-brushing the people involved in prostitution as victims, and wildly as the prosecutors and law enforcement agents are painting them as criminals. Some hard information and some hard precision of terms would have been helpful. From Non DeMillo.
Thanks for the letters. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
This morning's backyard quiz focused on a famous man in the history of Hawaii's beekeeping industry. On a Sunday afternoon in 1893, a swarm of bees was caught in a gust of trade winds and blown into the backyard of brothers Lee and Oswald St. John Gilbert. After observing the swarm, the two brothers became interested in bees, beekeeping, and above all else, honey production. Though they had no prior knowledge of the industry, the two began constructing their own hives and perfecting cutting-edge beekeeping techniques. Eventually, they formed the Sandwich Island Honey Company, which was the first company dedicated to the commercial production of honey and beeswax in Hawaii. For his contributions to the honey industry, Oswald St. John Gilbert was given a nickname by his contemporaries. For our backyard quiz, we were wondering if you could tell us what this nickname was. The answer is the Honey King. It's 8:48. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Hawaii Supply.
Picture is worth a thousand words, but what if you're trying to create a brand image in just one logo? How can you translate what the brand stands for into just one creatively designed image? Can Hawaii have a brand too? Eric Reese thinks so, and he's here to tell us about his work in the movie and entertainment industry, making some of the iconic posters that are seen worldwide. Eric, welcome to The Conversation.
Thanks for having me. Should I talk in my public radio voice?
Well, you certainly can. We'll get a lot of listeners who are loving it. So tell me a little bit about how you came to be in Hawaii after being quite successful in Los Angeles and the Hollywood group.
I actually stepped out of like inner Hollywood, if you will, and became an independent freelance contract designer. And then when the recession hit, everything that was greenlit stayed in motion, and all ideas outside of that were put on pause. And it was harder to get money to lend to make films. And so there was less outside need for people like me. So when you kind of struck with financial restriction, other options rise to the top. I came out here for a wedding in, I think, 2010. And it was like, why not? I mean, you can always go back.
Absolutely, sure.
You can always go back. I didn't actually think at the time that I was going to be able to transition my career in Hollywood to being a sustainable income source here in Hawaii. But I luckily was able to do that with a friend back in Los Angeles who had created a company that I worked for, then worked for in-house, then worked for out-of-house. He then sold that company, took a couple years off, reinvested in a new company, and they call me daily for work.
So what exactly does it take to be doing what you're doing? Tell us what a creative director does. And when you get a job, What does that entail?
Well, I have a wide array of different jobs and different categories. The heavy lifting is mostly entertainment, and that every job is different. So I could be working on a Jurassic World standee, or I could be working on a key art movie poster campaign for the new NWA film. I could be doing logos for, I mean, I worked on the new Mad Max film logos 9 years ago. I mean, it was that long ago. So you could read a script, you could get script notes, you could actually see a screener of the film before it comes out. You could get nothing besides still photography. And then the only requirement is you have to make magic, which is an awesome job. I mean, I'll complain about it sometimes, and then I have to realize I just worked on packaging the entire Star Trek original series into a box set, and the next day I was asked to work on new logos for a Star Wars trilogy. Like, I have to go, what? I had to do it in Hawaii.
I mean, and of all the things, it sounds like you found this wonderful place to live, and I don't want to say you didn't work hard enough, but you fell into this great career where you've really made it work despite not necessarily following a traditional path, and now you have work from everywhere. You also helped our earlier guest, Geraldine, and you helped him with Ohina Film Showcase.
Yeah, he's asked me to come on as the creative director to help rebrand it here on their 15th anniversary in 2015 with the second showing on the 15th of August, if you want to line those three things up. And you just said, like, the non-traditional path. That's the cool thing about entertainment is there is no traditional path. I'm going to get on a plane next week to fly to Atlanta for 10 days to follow my friend and producer around the set of Captain America 3, because I'm writing a script in my free time, and I want to see how big motion pictures are made, because I know how you can market a film, and I know that films are stories. And then making a film is totally different than you can even imagine. So there's no traditional path. Like, it's just relationships and the desire to keep creating stories and stories inside of stories inside of stories. You're asking me right now about my story, making stories to get people to go watch stories.
It's just all comes full circle.
Yeah. It's
now,
crazy.
Do you think Hawaii can have a brand image too?
I think Hawaii already has a brand image. Everybody, I say this, and I've heard people repeat this, people save their entire lives to come to Hawaii for one experience. One. I mean, we heard a grandfather on a beach talking about before his dying wish was to bring his family to Hawaii. I think he was from Europe. We overheard it. And someone's like, that's what you say all the time. And people have heard of Hawaii. Very few get to come here. And I think there's a greater opportunity with the advent of the digital age that we have and the speed of the internet and where it's going, that Hawaii has the opportunity to elevate their storytelling, package up the intellectual property that is their stories, and then push them off island and then get a financial return back to the island and become a hub, if you will, as long as you treat it respectfully. You know, like, I know what I look like. I'm white. I'm Howley. I know that you get a lot of people coming in and saying you're doing things the wrong way. So you don't. You got to come in and witness and observe and learn what the stories are and then try and help promote it to a level that you can. I think Hawaii can be a premium experience away from Hawaii, if that makes sense.
Well, and that's sort of what you've tried to do with your company, Brand Studios.
Yes. I'm actually currently rebranding my company from Etc. Studios to Brand Studios. So a branding company that's rebranding is almost meta, if you will. But I've been taking a lot of creative license and input from traditional Polynesian and Hawaiian art, but then not trying to stop there, where it's just triangles and rectilinear shapes that are etched in. It's, what is that essence? And then how would it have progressed if they had more influence from the outside world?
You've got some really exciting things going on, and we'll definitely keep an eye on what you're doing and have you come back and tell us some more about the work that you've been up to. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks much.
Eric Reese is the creative brainchild of Brand Studios, which is rebranding itself, and you can find more of his work on his website, linked from ours, hpr2.org.
Every memory you think you have of the past?
The house you grew up in. Your first kiss.
It's not simply an idea. It's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what it's like to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
That's this week on Radiolab.
Saturday morning at 10, following The Splendid Table.
Well, Kathy Kozak, you've been helping us out for the last couple of weeks while Beth Ann Kozlovich is on vacation. You've been enjoying yourself?
Oh, I have a great time. It keeps me up to date with what's going on with arts and culture here in the islands.
Well, you've got an arts and culture bent yourself. You're a violinist, right?
I'm a much better doctor than that. But, yeah, it's nice to meet the local musicians and get to premiere their work, too.
It's good to bring out another side of you. Thanks for helping us out, Kathy. And that's it for this week. Coming up next week, we'll talk with the executive director of the Hawaii Community Development Authority, Anthony Ching.
Plus, it's described as community theater at its finest. Hawaii Island's KDEN production of The King and I.
And we like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
If you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can find the playlist on our page at hpr2.org. That's also where you can listen back to today's show. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich, who will be back next week.
And Lillian Song produces the program. Taylor Rice is our production assistant. Jessica Hanau is our intern.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Kathy Kozak.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation.